Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We have our roundtable today looking at national news and what Donald Trump has been up to lately and his latest edicts, known as executive orders around immigration that came out on Wednesday. We're here with Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair Body Politics in Africana Communities, and also co-editor of Obama 2.0. Hasdai Westbrook is in the studio as well. He's founder and CEO of Changing Media. And joining us by phone is Rose Aguilar, who is host of Your Call Radio on KALW in San Francisco. And Kimberly, Hasdai, Rose, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm glad you all are here today. And so let me jump right into this. I mean, the news of the latest deportation news from Donald Trump, and which is a kind of trying to clean up his act from this last minister was about Muslims and Muslim bans and the rest that we talked about in the last several weeks. But this one seems to be a really hard look at a really kind of hard effort at using ICE to go after immigrants in this country in a major way. We saw evidence of that here in Baltimore, where people have been stopped in their cars, parked by ICE, posing as city policemen, then describing themselves, saying who they are, and saying things to people like, "Well, we have a new administration in town, and we're going to see more of this. We're here now, and you're not going to get away." So, Rose, I think that this is this next level of heightening up around deportations. I wonder, where you think it's going to take us and your analysis of it.
We just did a week-long series on immigration. And it's important to remember that this did not start with the Trump administration. President Obama was called the deporter-in-chief because under his administration, so many people were deported. Now, Trump's policies go much, much further than Obama. And obviously, there's so much fear in communities. The one thing that really struck me, Mark, when we talked to immigrants last week across the country was looking at the simplistic coverage that this is getting in the media. And what we need to spend more time focusing on is why people come to the United States in the first place. And we interviewed a couple of undocumented students at UC Berkeley who are seniors, and their parents brought them here when they were young because of NAFTA. And, you know, these kids said, "Hey, the United States imposed policies on my country that forced my parents to work in American manufacturing plants making less than a dollar a day, and they couldn't feed their families, and so they had no choice but to come to the United States." And then if you look at Central and South America, U.S. foreign policy is the reason for a lot of people coming north. And then when you're talking about refugees, U.S. foreign policy is the reason that so many people from Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen are leaving their countries. And so I just wish that we could go up deeper and talk about why people come here in the first place. And that's what I feel has been missing from most of the media coverage that I've been reading and hearing over the past few weeks.
I do want to get to that, because I think we've been covering those kind of same issues as well about why people are even coming in droves to this country, why they did for such a long time, and how our policies in Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador has kind of forced and pushed this immigration. Just to talk a bit about what we're going to see more and more of, that what I was referring to in the very beginning here was the case of Sorbando Rodriguez, who is a businessman in Baltimore who owns his own barbershop and owns another company, was a leader of the Latino community here and a leader of the Honduran community, who was stopped at 2 o'clock in the morning sitting in his car with his girlfriend, just sitting there. ICE pulls up, posing as city police, pulls him out of the car, and then says, "We're from ICE, and now that Donald Trump is president, you're going to see a lot more of us here like this." And then takes him to, there are three facilities in Maryland that where people are taken. Mm-hmm. One of those is in Frederick, Maryland, to the west of Baltimore, and that's where he is going to be fighting his deportation. We'll be covering his story with some intensity over the next week. But I think we're going to be seeing, this is what happened to Sorbando, who's a really decent guy, only 35 years old. Kimberly, is what we're going to see on steroids, I think, coming in the months and years of this administration.
Yes, and It's interesting because as much as I think it's important to have the conversation about why are people coming to this country and what has the U.S. done to facilitate that, you know, Trump's position and those of his supporters are that doesn't matter. Our focal point is we don't want them here. And so the mission is to try and drive that population out so that we can apparently protect those of us who are real Americans and make sure that we are employed and living the life of prosperity that we certainly believe we're entitled to. But so it's, I do find it interesting that that Trump has no desire to have those deeper conversations. That is not where he is. It is about fulfilling a campaign promise and being able to demonstrate that he can carry out exactly what it is that he has said, regardless of how it's done. And if it is done in a way in which we have always supported as Americans, means nothing to us right now.
Asda, as an immigrant yourself.
As an immigrant, as I suppose, I don't know if I count myself as a real American, because I'm not entirely sure what that's supposed to mean. But yeah, I mean, I think here we have a pretty obscene example of the insanity that we're going through or entering into. I mean, here you have someone who was a pillar of the community who did nothing but good, is exactly the kind of story that we, you know, quote unquote, want, and has been torn out of his car into a essentially black hole site. You know, without any real due process, and you know, what possible public good could this serve? And you know, and it's sort of a sacrifice on the altar of an insane political xenophobic impulse, which of course has been with us, I suppose, from the inception of the United States, but is clearly something we should all oppose and fight. It's pretty horrifying, and it's also so detached from any reality. And makes me pessimistic about the possibility of rational debate, because yes, it's certainly true that, you know, there's been varying flows of immigrants for various reasons for many years. But for one thing, you know, and I am no expert, my understanding is that there has not been a net increase of immigrants, certainly from Latin America, from Mexico, in the past few years, because the economy hasn't been good enough, for one thing. So this notion of this marauding hordes of invading people coming for jobs or criminals, etc. And again, the criminal issue is, of course, also complete nonsense. In fact, if we're worried about crime, we should be welcoming immigrants into our country because they commit crime at a far lower rate. Their children then catch up to the bad influence of native people. You know, so I don't know what will happen to me, perhaps, right? You know, as immigrant. But no, it's absurd. It is totally obscene.
And I think that the Sarbandos of the world rose. I mean, one of the reasons he came to this country, you were alluding to that earlier, was the violence in his country that took place when he had a business there as a barber that he had here. Mm-hmm. And some of that violence is, in fact, the right-wing militias that came out of the money we spent in Honduras to overthrow the government, A. And B, also has to do with the amount of Honduran gang members who were deported from this country, who had been not born here, but had been raised since they were children, who are now raising havoc inside of this place where he lived.
But one of the things that I think gets lost here is that we keep trying to have this very intellectual conversation with leaders currently who have no interest in that whatsoever. And so while all of what you say is accurate and helps to explain why we've seen this so-called flow of immigrants into illegal immigrants, and I'm doing the parenthetical expression, is because of so much of what we have participated in. But again, you're looking for us to have those rational conversations with people who are unwilling to even engage in that fashion. Trump said, I'm deporting 11 million illegal immigrants out of this country. And if he can stand by that particular campaign promise and prove his supporters right by following through, that's all that matters.
Rose, I'm sorry, you were about to say what?
There was an interesting study. Professors from Cornell and the University of California looked at coverage of the New York Times since the 80s and found that back in the 80s, public opinion was not so divided on immigration. But as the coverage became much more negative and focused on criminals and Latinos, even though immigrants from Mexico are not coming here in large numbers, they found that people's opinions started to split because they were reading about these criminal elements of immigration. And so you had Republicans become staunchly anti-immigrant, and you had Democrats, I mean, this is pretty simplistic, but liberals, Democrats, being a lot more open to, quote, immigration reform. And so the media coverage has such an effect on public opinion about this issue. And it's just like so much of the media now, it's so simplistic and sound bites. There's a really good documentary that I wish we could hijack the cable shows and play this documentary called Harvest of Empire. And it looks at why people in South America and Central America come here and looks at the effects of US foreign policy. And you know, a lot of the young people that I interviewed who are undocumented, they are putting so much on the line by writing op-eds and speaking out and putting actions together, knowing that they could be deported. And, you know, I live in San Francisco, and some of the comments on these stories are ruthless. They're mm-hmm. ugly, mm-hmm. racist. I mean, this is happening in San Francisco. And so I asked them, why are you writing New York Times op-eds? Why are you coming on the radio show? And they said, you know what? At this point, storytelling is all we've got. And we have to connect with people to tell them why we're here, what we contribute, and where we come from. They said at this point, it's all we've got.
So, go ahead, Jose.
Yeah, sorry, just to quickly say how much I agree. And I mean, and that's a great point about how fundamentally this is an emotive narrative issue. And I mean, I remember years ago, even it's been going on, this is a sort of undercurrent that has now bubbled up. I mean, I wrote something for the Huffington Post, I think, which is about how as a legal immigrant, as theoretically I should be against legal immigration, but I think that's nonsense. And the ferocity of the comments, I had never experienced anything like that. And I think it goes to something that you talked about, Mark, I think in a previous conversation we had, one of the fundamental emotional issues here is this deep anxiety among a shrinking white majority population. And I think that this is a fundamental part of that. And it's something, as you said, that we're going to be dealing with the implications of for decades to come. And just one quick point about history, and I think, you know, it's interesting how this doesn't get into the debate. I mean, people have been coming here for various reasons, and we can have a long discussion debate about the various reasons from the founding of this country, but we didn't have any policies or real restrictions. And again, I'm not an expert, but this is what I understand, on that immigration until the 20s when we put in some racist ones. So, you know, the history of restriction is fundamentally related to xenophobia and racism from the start. I think something we need to acknowledge and recognize.
So one of the things... Go ahead, Rose. I'm sorry, then I'll jump in.
Mark, one more point. I think politicians have really failed the public on this issue because here in California, we have so many farm workers. In fact, the fruits and the vegetables that you eat were probably picked in the Central Valley. And the plight of farm workers has not gotten that much better since the days of the grape marches and Cesar Chavez. I mean, farm workers just 2 years ago were dying in the heat because it's so hot out in the Central Valley. And people had to fight just to ensure that they had shade and they had water. And so it's so also so important to remember that we tend to have the students, the people going to UC Berkeley on the show, but a lot of people who are immigrants, they don't have the microphone. And I mean, they're just fighting for shade and for water. And politicians have really failed these people.
I mean, one of the things about this particular order, and I've been trying to wade through some of the stuff here, and not completely, but as much as I could before we spoke. But this, the way it's written, there are two things here. A, the way it's written allows the DHS and others to kind of have a very broad swath about how they're going to approach this. One official said, the fact that you are not, this is a quote, the fact you're not a priority does not exempt you from potential enforcement, noting that people with crimes like DUIs or status violations or non-criminal histories could still have a final order of removal, no matter who you are. And that he's asking Congress to give him 15,000 more people to work in his immigration forces to go out and round people up. So this sounds like, I mean, this is growing to a point where it could be, you know, it could cause a huge havoc inside of immigrant communities, and the fear is already there. It's palpable.
So it's creating fear in immigrant communities, but it's creating jobs in other communities. Mm. And from a Republican standpoint, that works for Donald Trump, and it certainly works for his supporters to believe he is fulfilling his promises.
Until you get farmers saying that they can't find workers to work in the fields,
absolutely,
which has already happened over the last 5 to 10 years, farmers will say, you can't pass these laws because we cannot find people to pick our blueberries. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the reality that's going on in the farms. And look at the restaurants. I mean, you know, in California, the wealthiest state in the country, in the Bay Area, there's so much money. I mean, immigrants are the workers in the restaurants. They keep things going. That's why a day without immigrants is such an effective action, because it gets people thinking, oh, right, what would it be like if these 11 million undocumented immigrants were deported? And like you said, Mark, based on what I've read, we're talking about 11 million people have the potential of being deported based on the executive orders, these memos signed by Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly.
So I'm just curious. We're sitting here in a fairly partisan room at the moment.
I'm trying.
So the question is, what is a response to this? I mean, on a couple of levels. I mean, there's very little. I mean, we talk about sanctuary cities. As the mayor here in Baltimore said, this is a welcoming city, not a sanctuary city. In the Bay Area, there are sanctuary cities. New York is a sanctuary city. The number of cities that are calling themselves sanctuary cities, but that really is paper. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's symbolic. Yeah. It's important symbolism, but it's symbolism nevertheless. Nothing can legally stop ICE and immigration officials from going in and taking who they want. Right? I mean, one thing, as we said in the show, we had the lawyers on the show just earlier in the week who are answering immigrants' questions that, you know, that you do not have to answer the door if ICE bangs at your door unless they have a warrant signed by a judge. Hmm. They don't tell you that, but they have no right to come in without a warrant signed by a judge. That's important for people to know. Doesn't mean they still can't come in and take you away.
Doesn't mean they won't.
So the question is, what is a response? What is a community's response? What's a political response? Because many people feel powerless in the face of what they see coming down the pike.
Well, I think what I see some community-based organizations doing is making sure that citizens and non-citizens do know what their rights are and are aware of those points that you don't have to answer the door unless... Right. Those are details that I think individuals need to be aware of. But only because we're hearing so much via news media, that might not be the information that is disseminated to that level. And I think that's why community-based organizations have become so important to disseminate that type of information. We've been doing it at UMBC. And our numbers in terms of immigrants are not, I mean, we are a diverse campus, but in terms of international immigrants, is not significant numbers. But we're doing a number of programs on campus to make sure students understand what their rights are around these issues.
Rose, what's the response?
Basically the same thing. And here in the Bay Area, there have been a number of clinics to let people know what their rights are. There are calls for the city of San Francisco to add more money to a legal fund to represent immigrants. Other than that, Mark, I mean, the last time we had big roundups, it just happened and people put out on social media, you know, go to this area, go to that area, put your bodies on the line. We don't know how this is going to come down. I mean, last week, I believe it was, the AP broke that story about the National Guard also getting involved and going as north as Portland, Oregon. So a lot of this is just wait and see. But in the meantime, some people are coming out and telling their stories. A lot of people are just living in fear and not leaving their homes in some cases.
I mean, yeah, it's tough because, I mean, not only is this does this all have the power of law, if not legitimacy, it also has the power of lawlessness, because these agencies mm-hmm. have an institutional culture that is very aggressive, even at the best of times. And the leeway this gives them simply encourages more bad behavior. And we already had it with the travel ban customs agents essentially lying and coercing people into giving up their legal rights. So that is a problem that's very difficult to solve. I mean, one thing I think to keep in mind is first that this is an attack not only on individuals themselves, but on families and communities. And to the extent, as I guess symbolic as it might feel, that we are out there showing those families and communities that we care and that we are in solidarity with them, and showing the rest of society that this is unacceptable and that we take a stand, that is at least something we can do. I also fully agree that, again, as we've been talking about, this is a narrative issue. The more that we can hear from the voices of the people who are affected, and the more they tell their stories, hopefully we can at least address some of the redress some of the imbalance of narrative that we've had, as was alluded to, with the media and so on.
Well, that's what we're going to try to do here. I know Rose will be doing the same thing out where she is, to bring those stories to the airways and to really put them out there in a very real and creative way for people to grab a hold of. I mean, because right now there's this debate. I mean, and none of us know where the truth lives, that the Atlantic Monthly, other places, reported that the Trump presidency is considering mobilizing 100,000 National Guard troops. He denies it. He's saying this is not in the works. People are saying, insiders are saying, it has been discussed. I mean, let's take, for argument's sake for a moment, say that that takes place. I mean, that the idea that we're even contemplating using military forces to go into Latino communities, which and what we're talking about here is mostly Latino communities, right? Going into different Latino communities and using the National Guard. I mean, it's a pretty scary thought. I mean, this is, you know, this is the kind of time where you think about what you said, Rose. I think it was you who said it, putting your bodies on the line and saying we can't stand in between. I remember in the 1960s, being the old man in the room, that there were times when the government was forcibly trying to stop the Black Panthers and to literally kill people, and people kind of made the moral presence by sitting, sleeping in front of Black Panther headquarters and offices. The police would have to come through you first before you can get into the Panther headquarters or Panther offices. I mean, are we reaching that point where people have to consider putting themselves on the line to protect people the same way we're thinking about it in terms of what would happen with people if their rights to an abortion are taken away? I'm saying, you know, these things are it's just not fantasy.
No,
but I think in those situations, how should I put this? There would be a kind of optic and moral clarity to the situation. That's obviously a terrifying scenario. We should be clear that it has not been confirmed yet. Although
it's not been confirmed.
There is a ramping up, and there's certainly an effort. So that's crazy. But let's hire 15,000 more, whatever. One thing also to fear is that this will be done more insidiously. That simply will be, as has already happened, an expansion of discretion, and that will happen mostly under the cover of night, under the cover of pretending to be police officers in individual, you know, pinpoint places, but on a grand scale, and in ways that will be hard to kind of identify in a media narrative and optically, and one that will be of very little consequence to the people who are supporting these policies, because it's not going to be their neighborhoods where this comes in. We know demographically and geographically that it's the people who live generally nowhere near immigrants who want the immigrants out of this country for whatever reason we can discuss. But so this doesn't, it's not going to be like their neighbors are being hauled out in the middle of the night. It's not going to happen to them. It's going to be very far away to people who they don't obviously care very much about. So, yeah, I mean, I think there are two possible scenarios, neither of them particularly good.
Rose Aguilar?
I agree. I mean, I've been reading a lot about the potential for the National Guard to be deployed, and it's going to get ugly. I mean, like you said, Mark, from this to abortion to the environment to cuts on Social Security and Medicare, I think we're in for a very frightening and ugly four weeks. I'm sorry, 4 years. Too bad it wasn't 4 weeks.
One can only hope you're right the first
thing. Yeah, 4 years.
One can only hope you're right about the second thing you said.
Yeah.
No. I mean, of course, 4 weeks means you have Pence, but that's a whole other question, different question.
Which none of us are looking forward to. No, I don't think there's anything to add except to echo the sentiments that have already been conveyed, that these are scary times. And just because it's not something that is directly affecting us personally in the sense of our families, I think it is important for us to stand, as Americans say they do, to protect their brothers. Mm-hmm. And to give examples for our children and those younger generations of how we do that, and we don't do that by some of the actions that the president is currently taking.
It's really hard, it is hard to say where this is all going to end up. I do think that.
So, you know, there's a professor in Florida at Florida Atlantic University that is still saying this presidency will end before 199 days.
The fellow who predicted the election.
No, it's a different, it's a historian who, no, I think he gave up after he didn't predict the election.
No. Such a great record.
Well, I mean, that raises other issues as well. I mean, I think that someone on this program said that the other day, and actually it was a Republican who said this on the show the other day, that his prediction was that this would be the shortest presidency since William Henry Harrison.
Right, right. And so this would be, and this historian is saying the same thing, that it would be the second shortest presidential term ever.
But isn't there, I mean, I feel like there's a danger in, I mean, it feels like wishful thinking. I mean, would that it comes true. But I think that there, I think there's still an inability to accept the reality. And that's part of it. It's like, this couldn't possibly be happening and this can't possibly persist. And I think,
and yet
and yet it does. And I think one has to be open to the possibility and even think psychologically, what if this is an 8-year term? What if this is a 2-term presidency? Mm. It's not beyond the realm of possibility. It seems so obscene to us, of course, and absurd. But I mean, obviously there is a potential for that to go on. And I think there is a kind of temptation to be lulled into a false sense of security again, as was true, I think, before the election, that this can't possibly go on. So I don't need to, like, do that extra action. I don't need to go to that meeting. I don't need to go to that rally. I don't need to fight as if every day is important and that my actions don't matter. I think there is still that kind of complacency that's still in the air a bit. Obviously, I think people have been energized, but it still worries me, even when people talk in those terms, that, you know, I think it's almost like a prayer. It's like, and I don't know that there's any rational basis for it yet, necessarily.
You know, Rosa, before we go to break, I have to ask you this. The articles I was reading the other day about the people talking about California seceding from the union. Being in the middle of all that out there, how serious is that conversation?
Not very serious. I mean,
just I
the Hail Mary.
You know, the Democrats actually control both houses here in California, which means that they have a supermajority. They do not need one Republican vote to pass a tax increase or a bill. And, you know, I've been talking a lot the last couple of weeks about how our Democrats in California are getting so many plaudits and kudos for taking on the Trump administration, which is not that difficult. And yet we have such a high poverty rate in California. A new study just came out that found 754,000 young children live in poverty in this state. Massive inequality, older people barely getting by on $1,000 a month. And this is what we're seeing across the country. And as a journalist, really to give people a voice, I mean, what's scary to me is that Trump's policies are going to hit the most vulnerable really hard. And while the talking heads are analyzing possible impeachment and who's fighting in the White House, in the meantime, these policies are going to really cause a lot of suffering. And I just hope that we can spend more time talking about that, because everything is on the chopping block. And that deserves a lot more attention.
So we will talk about that. And I do want to kind of move into this question of where Democrats are and what politically this means in the second part of our conversation. You just heard the voice of Rosa Aguilar, who is host of Your Call Radio on KALW in San Francisco, Hasdai Westbrook, who is founder and CEO of Changing Media, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and often a co-host and substitute host here on The Mark Steiner Show, and co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. Take a short break. We'll come right back. Stay with us. Here on The Mark Steiner Show. I'm going to remind you on the way back to this conversation, The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, has been helping its members and its community prosper for the last 80 years. When you invest in yourself, MeQ belongs to you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank, belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com. And we are looking at, in our national roundtable today, the latest to come out of the Trump White House, but even more importantly now about where this goes from here. This weekend, the Democrats will be deciding on who the next chairman of the Democratic National Committee will be. Very significant, probably more significant now than it has been in a long time. We are here with Rosa Aguilar, who is host of Your Call Radio on KALW in San Francisco, Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, associate professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, co-editor of Blackberries and Redbones, Critical Articulations of Black Hair, Body Politics, and Africana Communities. and co-editor of Obama 2.0, and Hasda Westbrook, founder and CEO of Changing Media. So this weekend, that to pick up the kind of theme that Rose left us with before we went to break, to talk a bit about the reality of poverty on the ground, the reality of what America faces, why Democrats did so poorly and why they're doing so poorly, and the fact that this weekend there'll be this massive debate and conclave to figure out who's going to become the next chairman of the DNC. And it has huge consequences, symbolically and practically, about the direction they're going to go in. And I think Democrats are as confused as Republicans are, but in a much more different way. So where do we think about that? Who would like to leap in first? How's that? Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I don't know. When it comes to this kind of thing, I've been sort of starting to adopt a, what was it, the Reagan rule of thou shalt not criticize fellow Republicans or something like this. But it's a little paradoxical because on the one hand, my feeling is in accordance with that principle, obviously someone's going to be disappointed at the end of this process, whoever wins. My strong counsel would be like, the stakes are too high. Don't go off in a huff. Don't take your marbles and go home. But then again, also in keeping with this principle, I will not criticize anyone for feeling that way or expressing that sentiment because I don't want to in any way further alienate them. So I think it's tricky. But I mean, I don't know, I'm not sure if these things have sort of been polled out or something like that. But it's I may be wrong, but it seems to me the two leading candidates, if I'm correct, it's Ellison and the former Labor Secretary, is it Perez?
Perez. Though there are others there, too.
I mean, I know they kind of represent sort of different parts of the party in terms of their kind of affinities, but are they very far apart? And this is an open question. I don't know that they answer this question in terms of their approach and their ideology. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, it's been interesting to watch Donald Trump endorse Keith Ellison to be head of the DNC because he was the only one who predicted that he would win.
Yeah.
So he couldn't win.
So he must be smart.
It's right. So just why. But Rose, I mean, so you know, I mean, you've had some really interesting analysis over the past. We've spoken about the Democrats. How important do you think this is?
I've been kind of laughing watching some of these Democrats go to these rallies and grab one of these microphones and try to rally up the crowd. I mean, a lot of these Dems, they hardly ever hold town halls, and to sound like an activist is kind of new to them. But there's so much movement on the ground. I mean, I covered the Women's March, and I've been following people who are going to these town halls and raising hell. People are calling into the show on a regular basis saying they want to do more. I mean, this is really, depending on what happens with the DNC, and we also should talk about, well, how much power does the chair of the DNC have? But raising money also is really also part of the DNC, right? Because the Democrats raise a lot of money, not as much as Republicans, but still a lot. And so that's the question at hand. Are they going to continue down that path and raise money from multinational corporations and Wall Street? Or are they going to go down, which, you know, is called the Bernie path, where they raise money from small donors and they take a completely different tactic? A lot of people think that the Democrats either need to do a 180 or it's time for a third party, because the path of this neoliberal package of policies is not working. I mean, I know I keep sounding like Debbie the Downer on the show, Mark, but I mean, we just did a show today about women in Detroit who are having a hard time making ends meet. And I just feel like a lot of people are living in this strange bubble. We are going to have so many social problems in the next 5 to 10 years. Massive homelessness. People are not going to be able to make ends meet. I mean, you now even have some politicians talking about a universal basic income because so many jobs are going to be automated. In fact, in San Francisco, I just read this interesting article in the Chronicle about how people are driving from Los Angeles to San Francisco. Now, this is an hour plane ride. It's about an 8-hour drive. To drive for Uber and Lyft. And they work 4 straight days. In some cases, they sleep in their cars because the prices are higher in San Francisco than LA. And so they'd rather spend 4 days here making a chunk of money and then going back home. I mean, this is what people are doing to make ends meet, sleeping in their cars to drive for Uber and Lyft. Now, we know that if Uber had its way, they would have driverless cars, which I think is unreal. You can't solve poverty, but we can have driverless cars. But this is the way we're going. And I don't hear many politicians being really honest with the public about what we're actually facing and what's to come.
Well, I mean, what this is, you know, Kimberly, the question of the Democratic Party and where it may go or may not go. I mean, under Howard Dean, the Democratic Party at least strategically made a shift to go after all 50 states, mm-hmm. which I think made a huge difference in their power in terms of just straight Democratic Republican views of the issues. But the reality is that you look at who did not vote. That 10 million people fewer voted in 2016 than voted for Obama in 2008. Mm-hmm. Many of those were white voters who ended up voting for third parties, not for Trump. The analysis is really skewed. Voting for third parties, which helped make the difference in some very key states, mm-hmm. like Wisconsin and other places. Mm-hmm. In Pennsylvania, one of the key things was I have to kind of get the numbers here, which I'll pull them out in a minute, but the loss was because so many black voters decided, mm-hmm. we're just disillusioned, yeah. we don't mm-hmm. care, we're not coming out. So I mean that is part of the
and I think that's exactly what people are thinking mm-hmm. about this DNC election too. That the head of the DNC does nothing for the bottom line for many of these families who feel disillusioned or feel disaffected from the process. And so there are those of us who are very in tune and pundits who want to be a part of these conversations. But I think a number of other people are saying it makes no difference and don't see how that individual will somehow effectively change how the Democratic Party is positioning itself to be successful in the future.
So when people talk about, and Rose raised this issue, so let me raise the issue with the three of you. When we talk about third parties, we live in the United States here. The last time there was a third party that made a difference and really won anything was when the Republicans were created in 1856. Out of a combination of disaffected Whigs and abolitionists inside the Whig Party and the abolitionist movement outside the party, came in and the party exploded, and out of that party explosion came the Republicans, mm-hmm. which even the most radical abolitionists went for because they wanted to end slavery and they were trying to push this issue. Mm-hmm. Fremont was their first candidate in 1856, then Abraham Lincoln in 1860. So, but that was the last time a third party that grew out of a split inside of an established party, the Whigs, created a third party. The other times people tried to create a third party, whether it was the progressives in the late 40s after Truman and FDR, the progressives were there, and Strom Thurmond ran his third party, States' Rights Party. You've had, you know, right-wingers like Wallace running in, mm-hmm. in their party, these populists, like he was a lot like Trump. You have the Greens, who can't seem to get off the ground at all, for lots of reasons, I think. And so what does it mean when we say third party? And where does that come from? If there's not the internal contradictions in the Democratic Party that allow some kind of massive exodus from the people who found a home in the party, namely African Americans, many Latino populations, women, GLBTQ communities, which found a home inside there because their voice was there, even the power is not completely there, and don't talk to the issues of poor people in this country and working people. So what does that third party mean, given all that madness I just threw out?
I think we've had, in a sense, the Bernie movement has been at least a temporary third party. I mean, from a purely poli-sci point of view, the bar for a third party, certainly for a presidential election in the United States, is incredibly high, even compared to other electoral systems. I mean, and you know, it's the bar for a successful third party is difficult, even in a place like the UK, where, I mean, there are third parties. I mean, I can, you know, with good conscience sometimes vote Lib Dem versus Labour and be, oh, you know, it's okay. And at least enough people on my side of the political divide will theoretically get into power to stop the worst possible outcome. That's just not generally true in the United States. However, I think the kind of the general historical verdict on this is that, with a couple of exceptions, third parties in America, left or right, they rise up, they sting, and they die. And so... often with very significant results, whether it's on the right wing or the left wing. So I think that there is certainly a power, at least historically, in third-party movements, but I think it's unrealistic to ultimately expect that they would break away unless they entirely kill off the party that they break away from, I think their effect is to as a wake-up call of some kind to the party from which they are detaching or rebelling, to sort of defend a flank and recalibrate.
Yeah, I agree. I think although we are complex as human beings, that we are so entrenched in this binary of it has to be right and left or conservative and liberal and nothing else exists. And so even if we don't necessarily see ourselves in alignment with either of those two parties, we try and make it work. We put that square into that round hole, or at least attempt to feel comfortable and connected and a part of a much larger community. So as much as I'd like to see greater diversity and greater numbers of people coming together to say, we've got a different voice and believe that could be the future of the U.S., I really struggle to see when that's going to happen.
And so, and I didn't want to be raising the issue. I raised it, Rose, I didn't want to be Donald Dower. Donald. But I mean, that is reality. What you've raised the issue a lot about third parties. What does a third party mean? I mean, how do you even begin to get there?
In California, for example, we have a lot of independent voters. So these are voters who do not want to align themselves with the Republicans or the Democrats. We've got about 23% of our voters are no party preference or declined to state. That's big. And a lot of people are leaving the parties to become independent. And so I think that's the trend that we're going to see as we move forward. And when you talk to these people, so many of them talk about money and politics. And I think it's so interesting that during the election, the media loved to talk about how Bernie supporters and Trump supporters were the renegades in the country, right? They don't like Washington. They're outsiders. And well, what happened to that? I mean, people are angry about money and politics. We hardly ever hear the national media talk about money and politics. People are so disgusted by corruption, regardless of where you stand on the political spectrum. And we're not really even talking about corruption. So I think there's a lot of misinformation in the media right now about how we're so divided in this country. That's the one thing that always gets me. And they love the story about being divided, probably because it sells, but it's lazy, and I think it's dangerous in some ways. If you look at where people stand on issues like Citizens United, minimum wage, keeping Social Security strong, even abortion, you have about 60% or higher agree with these things. And in fact, the Wall Street Journal did a poll a couple of years ago. Pew just came out with a poll that found 7 in 10 people believe Roe v. Wade should stand. It's the highest level of support for that decision ever. And yet, what are we told on a regular basis? That abortion is so divided. So I think I agree that there's lots of complexities, but if you take the word Democrat and Republican out of the conversation, you find that people are really angry about money in politics. They're really angry about corruption. They're angry that they don't have decent health care. They're not making a decent wage. I mean, on study after study, people are in alignment on a lot of these issues. It's just that extreme politicians are making the decisions, or politicians that have been bought and sold, and they do the exact opposite of what the people want.
But I just, go ahead, Heather.
Just to jump in quickly, sorry. I mean, I think it's interesting how this relates to a previous question about the DNC, and a question we didn't really ask is exactly how relevant is the DNC? What we're seeing is a phenomenon. We're talking about third parties, but what about what's happening with the parties? We're seeing a phenomenon of weakening party structures with strengthening party affiliation. That's been the pattern that's played out. I mean, Donald Trump, if he represents any kind of ideology, I'm not sure, any coherent ideology. But look, I mean, this is a movement, or whatever you want to call it, that essentially took over the Republican Party in a matter of months and turned it into supposedly a party, at least rhetorically, that is protectionist, all these things the Republican Party wasn't supposed to be. You had a similar phenomenon, I think, with Obama in 2008, where this kind of insurgent movement came over and took over the party structure and unfortunately was bottled up, as we know from this New Republic article. We know the sort of blow behind the scenes of how that grassroots movement was kind of bottled up into nothingness, unfortunately. But I think we saw it to a certain extent with again with Bernie. You almost got there same time around. So I think right now we're in a strange situation where, again, these structural issues that make third parties an unlikely avenue. Nonetheless, we have the situation where movements can move the needle within these party structures. So I think that's sort of an interesting avenue to think about. And again, how relevant is DNC when we have this resistance movement that is welled up, which is in some ways analogous to the Tea Party movement that completely blew by and bypassed the RNC on the Republican side. Granted, it had lots of billionaire support, but still, you know, it essentially, to a certain extent, made them irrelevant, at least for a time. So I think we're dealing with a kind of shifting dynamic here.
I mean, I think that this movement that opposes what Trump represents, that has taken to the streets by the millions, is really broad. I mean, it's the Democrats we're talking about here, who are mainstream, who cannot stand what just happened, to people who are outside that spectrum. And, you know, every time, like the Women's March, it was started, called themselves the Million Women's March, and which started by these white women who that got a lot of women of color, especially black women, extremely upset, saying you just can't appropriate the name that we created in 1997 and make it your march. But it morphed, and many of those women became the leadership of the march that took place. So you, not necessarily the masses of people who were there, but became part of. So it's a very confusing and amorphous moment and movement. And I don't know how that gets harnessed, what the response is. If you look at the way our country is structured politically, it's very difficult to unseat these people who are in power, given the way we have it in this country. And so, you know, that's what I'm saying, that we are in, we're in a very weird and strange place. Stranger than I've ever experienced in my lifetime, or even reading American history outside the Civil War.
It's like the old curse, may you live in interesting times, right?
Yeah. Right. I mean, so it really does become a question of where politically this moves ahead. Do people put their energies into electing people in 2 years in Congress and state legislatures and state governments? Do they put their energies in movements that are outside of that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think people really are adrift. They are resisting, but they're adrift.
I think people have been hit so hard and they're finally sort of waking up from this nightmare and realizing that it's not a dream and they have to keep mobilizing. And, you know, even as a journalist, I mean, we keep thinking, what do we focus on? Let's not get lost in the weeds. Let's not get lost in the press conference of the day, because it's just noise. I mean, it's dangerous for sure, but these policies that are being passed really affect people. The one thing we haven't talked about, Mark, which never gets talked about, is the fact that over 90 million eligible voters did not vote in the election. And this is a huge untapped part of the country. I mean, you get a tiny percentage of these people voting, you could live in a different country. And I like to interview people who don't vote because they never get interviewed. And they're so aware of what's going on in the country because they're getting hit the hardest by these policies. But the people that I've interviewed say that they just don't feel like they matter, that the system is bought and sold and they don't matter. I mean, I'm hearing from a lot more people now who do not trust the system. That's pretty dangerous, and for legitimate reasons. But that needs to be dealt with, because if we keep going down this path, we're going to get a lot of people who are disenfranchised. And I think in the coming months, depending on what the Republicans do with healthcare, you're going to see a lot of angry Republicans. Vox did a really interesting story where they interviewed Republicans who voted for Trump, who love their healthcare. They love their Obamacare. And they didn't think he was going to do anything to Obamacare. They didn't think he was serious about that. And then Planned Parenthood had a focus group with a number of Republicans who voted for Trump and said, how do you feel about Mike Pence and his extreme anti-choice views and the Republican plan to gut Planned Parenthood? These Republican voters got so angry. They said, what are you talking about? He cannot touch Planned Parenthood. We rely on Planned Parenthood. My sister, my aunt, my friend relies on Planned Parenthood. So it's just fascinating to see now that all these policies are actually coming out, things that he talked about or the media didn't spend enough time on. I mean, remember during the VP debate, hardly any issues about social issues. Most people didn't even know that Mike Pence was so extreme, because the media didn't spend that much time on his legislation, the things that he's passed. So I think that a lot of Republicans are going to get really angry in the coming months once they find out what these policies are all about and how it's going to affect them.
And actually, as you were speaking, I was kind of looking up some stats, just trying to see if I had them right. When you said the 90 million, I saw that in the article as well. And the U.S. Elections Project, this is what they wrote, which is really interesting. The Elections Project notes that there were 251,107,404 people who are classified as members of voting age populations. So by their numbers, 115,449,897 people of voting age, or 46.3%, did not vote.
Wow.
If you take the entire number. That's a huge number of people who decided we're not voting.
So just to
go.
I mean, is the voting percentage versus all people who could possibly vote very dramatically out of line with most democracies, with history? I mean, just a note of caution. Obviously there's disenfranchisement and a kind of sense of despair, and there's also specific disenfranchisement in the sense of these voting restrictions, which I think is a very important issue. But I'm just curious, and I don't know, I think one should be careful a little bit with those statistics. In theory, lots of people might vote,
but if they've never done so,
or they don't do so in general, then it's not a pattern that we're diverging from. But it could be.
Yes, actually, the United States actually trails most developed countries. I mean, Belgium, Turkey, Sweden, South Korea, Denmark, Iceland, Norway. I can go on and on and
but
on.
But they're also required those to vote countries, in all of those countries. Not, again, not to, I believe. Not in the UK.
Australia. Australia is the only country where you have to vote. Well, but I mean, the United States is near the bottom of the list.
I'm sorry, but there are various countries where you're required to put in a ballot. A lot of people spoil their ballot. Certainly, Austria and other countries in Europe, you're legally required to vote. But again, I mean, I'm not saying categorically that this isn't a problem. I'm just inserting a note of caution about those numbers.
So, coming back to this, can kind of round up our conversation here, and just some final thoughts as we kind of wind down the hour. There's so many variables here about where this could go, from what this immigration policies could mean to attacking Planned Parenthood, the proposals to gut NEA and the National Endowment for the Humanities, and more. Every day there's another piece that they want to kind of detract. The opening up of federal lands to mining and ranching. One of the things that could happen conceivably is that for a brief moment, it could actually open jobs up, as Trump has promised.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right? This kind of dystopian vision of what could be unfolding that way, that's why I'm so interested in who the opposition is and where it goes. That to me is the unknown. I mean, it's almost, you can see where Trump is going and where the forces around him are going. The question is, what's the response if, in fact, he does these things that make it appear as if he's actually getting things done? Stunned silence.
No, I mean, I think that's a very...
All is true.
All is true, right. There's this danger that short-term he could inflate the economy in an unsustainable but attractive way to some people, bolstering his support. And I don't know that we know where one of the things that's either heartening or not heartening about Trump is that he is this sort of unpredictable force. What we do know is how some patterns have played out globally and how they're playing out globally. And there is a real risk of moving towards a kind of Putin-style illiberal democracy where you have a popular strong man who inflates the economy through, short-term thinking and uses sort of military force and supposed toughness to bolster his position and crush his dissent. I think that will be a slow process in America because it does still have some institutional safeguards and the resistance is awakened. But that's I think that's a real possibility that is not alarmist. And the downside of poo-pooing that that risk is so great versus the upside of being wrong. Not being confirmed. It's something I think we all have to really take seriously.
A quick closing thought from you, Rosa Aguilar, before we turn to Dr. Moffat.
Well, as the Dakota Access Pipeline water protectors are basically being kicked out of the camp,
yes.
talking about jobs, Mark, I was just looking at some numbers from Brookings, and it found that that pipeline is supposed to create up to 12,000 construction jobs, but just 40 permanent operating jobs. So, you know, it's important to get the facts out about how many jobs these would create, these pipelines would create. I think that his comments on the media calling us the enemy of the people is extremely dangerous, because since the Telecom Act passed under Bill Clinton, there have been so many media mergers. And when I was at Standing Rock a couple of months ago, driving from the main camp to Bismarck, North Dakota at 11 a.m., you don't have many options on the radio other than religious stations and Rush Limbaugh. And so, you know, I think we really need to be talking about media reform, because the media gave Trump $2 billion in coverage in the beginning. It was very uncritical. They followed him wherever he went and would barely talked about Bernie Sanders until the crowds got so big they had no choice but to talk about Bernie. But it's dangerous, because so many people do not trust the media. And under Trump, it's just going to get worse. And in a few articles I've read and TV pieces I've seen, when Trump voters are interviewed, they say that they only listen to Fox News. That's right. That's really dangerous.
That's right.
Closing thought, Kimberly.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo Rose's point that we are in dangerous territory when we are talking about the Fourth Estate being attacked in the way that it is, and seemingly receiving support for those attacks, that it's okay in which to do so, instead of continuing, again, in the spirit of what America says it stands for, to protect that voice and to make sure that the Fourth Estate is doing its task to disseminate information to us. We can get into the politics about what that means in terms of the slants of particular news stations or even radio stations, but I think it's still dangerous territory that we would allow our president to start those conversations and even get us into a point of believing that there needs to be something done to media.
You just heard the voice of Dr. Kimberly Moffitt, Associate Professor of American Studies at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And for that was Will Arr, host of Your Call Radio on KALW, and Hasdai Westbrook, who joins us now as well, founder and CEO of Changing Media. Thank the three of you so much for your time today on the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you.
Thank you.